Lecture 4, Spies of the Elizabethan Age.
Imagine this. You are an able government official in Europe around 1573, and you know one thing to the very core of your being. The world is a dangerous place for your monarch, your own kingdom, your religious faith, all of your way of life. There are spies abroad in the kingdom, sent by foreign powers, to prepare for invasion, to prepare for the assassination of your monarch, to completely overthrow the established order. But here's the problem. Your kingdom has no intelligence agency, no counterintelligence service. That's because nobody does. This is the pre-modern period, after all, early modern period. How would you set about creating an intelligence agency? Who would you turn to first? Who would you look to for advice? What things would you have to do immediately to forestall the surrounding threats? These were all the problems facing the spymaster of Queen Elizabeth of England. He had to invent his own job. The world of the Renaissance that we had discussed in our previous lecture was shattered by another wave of change, the Reformation. A movement for renewal within the church descended into vast violence, which soon took on a global scale. And the Christian world, or Christendom as it was known, was the scene for the horrific scandal of Christians killing Christians in a mutual slaughter over points of doctrine. The religious wars have been compared to the Cold War of our own times, with different ideologies facing off against one another in a conflict that seems nearly total and cannot be compromised. The Protestant Reformation was launched in 1517 by the German priest Martin Luther, excommunicated by the Catholic Church in 1521. Soon, many different states and societies were divided on the basis of remaining Catholic or becoming Protestant. With the religious wars, especially the horrific and protracted 30 Years' War of 1618 to 1648, this indeed would prove to be a long ideological and religious struggle comparable to the Cold War period. The Catholic Church sought to work against the Protestant challenge. A key and famous institution in the religious confrontation was the Order of the Jesuits, formerly titled the Society of Jesus, founded in 1534 by a former Spanish soldier, Ignatius Loyola. The Jesuits of the Catholic Church had not been founded originally for the sole purpose of opposing Protestantism, but in their energetic activities, this soon became one of their major tasks. The Jesuits understood themselves as soldiers of God, owing special loyalty to the Pope as the head of the Catholic Church. Jesuits acquired political influence by becoming confessors and spiritual advisors to important Catholic queens, kings, and princes throughout Europe. In the realm of education, they played another role. Jesuit schools became famous for their high quality and the lasting imprint they left on those who had attended them. In their extensive missionary activity, which we'll discuss in the next lecture, they formed what amounted to a global network of contacts and activity from Canada to India to China and Japan. In Protestant communities, the Jesuits were especially feared and suspected of masterminding any number of political conspiracies, of being permanently and energetically hypocritical. Jesuits, Protestants claimed, were masters of religious deception, leading people astray with sophisticated arguments, twisting logic and truth for the sake of achieving their narrower goals. Hence, even today, the term Jesuitical is not meant as a compliment, but instead is supposed to convey deception of the highest order. In this fraught and tense environment of early modern Europe, what did the political map look like? Well, Spain and France were seen as the leading Catholic powers. Protestants hoped that England might prove to be a special champion of their cause. King Henry VIII had broken with the Pope and had revolutionized government and created the Church of England as the English realm was declared an empire under his control. While Henry VIII, in fact, saw himself as a Catholic who had differences with the Pope, the logic of his position and of his successors pushed many of his subjects towards Protestantism. The Tudor consolidation of authority in England would continue under the long reign of Queen Elizabeth, who followed her father Henry VIII's impulse by reinstating the Church of England in place of the Catholic regime which Mary Tudor had revived before. In all, Elizabeth would probably have preferred to simply avoid religious controversy altogether. But in 1570, Pope Pius V declared a papal bull, a special document, which excommunicated Queen Elizabeth, and said that since she was a heretic, it would be proper for her to be deposed, and that all those in England who had pledged oaths of loyalty to her were hereby freed of those obligations. This was nothing less than an invitation to revolt. A few months after the decree was announced in Rome, a copy of it was nailed to the door of the Bishop of London's manor house during the night. The English Catholic who had done so was hunted down, tortured, and executed. Now the battle would be joined. Catholic priests trained in English Catholic seminaries abroad in exile, such as Douay in the Spanish Netherlands, were smuggled back into England, traveling in disguise and under false names. They traveled to celebrate Mass, to spread their message among the faithful in England. Soon, over 100 secret priests were active in England, sheltering in the homes of English Catholics and finding refuge in so-called priest holes, which still can be observed in tours of British manor houses to this day, special hiding places behind wainscoting or behind fake shelves where a cleric could be hidden from so-called priest takers, who were special hunters of Catholic priests who sought them as they moved around the country, and when they caught them, subjected them to torture and death. The feared Jesuits launched a special mission to England in the 1580s. Among the Jesuits who traveled to England was St. Edmund Campion, who had been a fellow at Oxford, and who on his capture was imprisoned in the Tower of London, tortured in between being forced to take part in public debates on religion, and then in 1581, hanged, drawn, and quartered. Another dozen Jesuit missionaries would be executed in England in the next years. Because of the threatened position of Queen Elizabeth, this period saw the growth of espionage and counterintelligence as a professional service. And there was one man who would be absolutely pivotal in building the institutional bases for intelligence services, and that was Sir Francis Walsingham. Walsingham was principal secretary to the Queen from 1573 to 1590 when he died, and he has been called the father of modern intelligence in England. Walsingham is a perfect study for our purposes in the role of personality in intelligence work and organization. Walsingham was a true believer, an obedient servant of the Queen, and an ardent, committed Protestant. He was born in about 1532, we're not exactly sure, as the son of a lawyer in Kent, and he went on to study at Cambridge and practiced law himself. He was not a member of the high nobility, not born to that highest privilege, but was an English gentleman. When Queen Mary Tudor had come to the throne in 1553 and had reinstated Catholicism as the official religion, and had persecuted Protestants, Walsingham, like some 800 other English Protestants, had fled abroad. And Walsingham lived in exile for 5 years, studying in Padua, Italy, becoming fluent in French and Italian, seeing something of the world, all excellent preparations for his later career as spymaster to the Queen. When Queen Elizabeth's ministers noticed his talents from 1568 to 1570, he was hired to seek out foreign spies in London, demonstrating the connection between intelligence work and diplomacy that we'd already mentioned in an earlier lecture. He was the English ambassador to the French court in Paris from 1570 to 1573. And on his return, he became a member of the Privy Council of the Queen and became principal secretary, we would today say secretary of state, from 1573 to his death in 1590. Here was a man who would put the secret into secretary. Well, what was Walsingham's personality like? What did it contribute to his work? Walsingham had two frequent mottos or watchwords that he repeated to those around him. He said, "I think it less danger to fear too much than too little." The other motto was, "Knowledge is never too dear." It was just around this time that Sir Francis Bacon was also coining his famous motto that knowledge is power, and Walsingham would have agreed. In person, Walsingham was formidable. That the portraits that exist of him show this to this very day. He had a sharp face, a pointed beard, and piercing eyes. Some said he looked like the devil. They were mostly his critics. He had a dark complexion, which led Queen Elizabeth to nickname him the Moor, or the Ethiopian. And in fact, this was part of a running joke between Walsingham and his queen, so that whenever he ventured to give her advice, and Queen Elizabeth was not someone who took advice graciously, whenever he ventured to give her advice or to obliquely criticize her policy, that was even worse, Walsingham would begin by saying apologetically that he was a foreigner. Hailing from Ethiopia, this was how things were done in his homeland. He didn't know the customs of England. Walsingham wore black clothes, a stark white collar, and a black skull cap, which accented the shadowy look that he affected all the more, especially at a time when at the court, those who were in the presence of the queen would wear splendid dress, where rich velvets and bright silks were the order of the day. It was said, moreover, of Walsingham that he had the gift of silence, the ability to watch and listen. It seemed to some contemporaries that being with Walsingham was like being with a vacuum that was sucking up all of the secrets and information around him. Walsingham insisted that it was wise to listen to all that one could, to listen to many people's reports, but to trust only a select few. Walsingham was a man of strong and stern beliefs, a determined Puritan. As a wonderful recent biography by Budyansky puts it, he was, quote, a Puritan and a Renaissance man, a strange and powerful combination, a zealot who knew how to keep his mouth shut, end quote. Another contemporary observer commenting on Walsingham made a fascinating observation that Walsingham was inclined to work on humors as well as by reasoning. And that Walsingham said that one had to observe, it is a marvelous phrase, the joints and flexures of affairs. Walsingham was someone who understood that people were not motivated only by rationality, but also by feelings and beliefs. As a spymaster to the Queen, Walsingham organized a cohort of agents, informers, and spies. They blended domestic and foreign observation and were always on guard to defend the Queen. His followers included merchants, seamen, men on the run, questionable people of all types, exiles of many nations, renegade English Catholics, cryptologists, and perhaps noted writers, including Christopher Marlowe, who died under mysterious circumstances after a celebrated literary career. This was not yet a professional, regular bureaucratic force, however, nothing like a modern intelligence agency. Most of its employees were in it for the money, rather than spying as a career or out of ideological conviction, especially the shady and marginal characters. Walsingham would frequently, moreover, have to pay his assistants himself out of his own pocket, rather than out of a regular government budget. And the notoriously thrifty Queen Elizabeth did not provide the needed resources to cover all these expenses. Yet Walsingham has been called one of those rare spymasters who did not use that role to enrich himself, but ended up losing by it. Note that this was a network built around him in very personal terms, not yet a firmly founded part of the state. When Walsingham looked out at the world, he saw many dangers. One was immediate, the other very real yet potential. Spain, under King Philip II, was the leading Catholic power, and Walsingham was worried about its intentions. He had spies throughout Europe tracking Spanish policies and explored an alliance with Catholic France against Spain as the greater evil. The other internal worry was more immediate, and that was a person. It was Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots, who was positioned to inherit the throne in England if anything were to happen to Queen Elizabeth. Mary Stuart also was a Catholic, and thus she was inevitably the focus of plots to restore Catholic rule in England. After an uprising against her rule in Scotland, where she had been crowned queen, Mary had fled to England in 1568, and she sought refuge there but was a most unwelcome guest, essentially under house arrest. Mary was, by the accounts we have of her, not classically stunningly beautiful, but nonetheless tremendously charismatic, able to attract people to her side, to win the loyalties and sympathies even of some of her jailers. This fact of her attraction and her charisma continues to this very day, because Mary Stuart really remains a quintessentially romantic figure of interest. Elizabeth and her servant Walsingham felt very little sympathy for Mary Stuart, but the risks involved in her presence they felt most keenly. Walsingham watched and waited, trying to intercept the secret communications that he knew flowed between Mary, Queen of Scots, and her supporters abroad, especially channeled through the French ambassador to England. Surprisingly, Walsingham got a tip from a man serving in the very house of the French ambassador in London, volunteering his services. This secret tipster, still yet unidentified, in turn identified a man named Throckmorton as a key courier in the secret traffic, and said that he came at night to receive or give messages at the house of the French ambassador. This exposed to Walsingham's attention the so-called Throckmorton plot. Many of these plots have wonderful names. Francis Throckmorton came from an English Catholic family, had studied at Oxford, and had returned to England from the continent. Walsingham did not order his men to swoop in and seize Throckmorton immediately, along with the other plotters. Rather, this is a beautiful example of tradecraft, he bided his time, observing the plotters in action. Walsingham observed, hoping to unravel the entire network for a bigger payoff later rather than immediate short-term success. Choosing his moment for maximum effect, Walsingham finally did have his agents burst in at the strategically right moment in on the home of Throckmorton in London in 1583, and they caught him just as he was encoding a secret message for Queen Mary and working on a list of Catholic nobles and gentlemen loyal to Queen Mary's cause. Under torture on the rack, a machine specially designed for stretching a victim to agonizing extremes, tearing at muscle and bone, Throckmorton admitted that he and others had been planning for a French and Spanish invasion of England, had actually scouted out landing sites along the English coast for the invading armies, and named the names of fellow conspirators, including the Spanish ambassador in London, who was expelled as a result. Due to his diplomatic immunity, they couldn't hold him to account in other ways. Although the French ambassador had also been linked to the plotters, Walsingham made sure he was not touched, because he did not want to compromise the agent that he had placed in his household. At Throckmorton's trial, the French connection was not mentioned and was edited out of his confession. In 1584, Throckmorton was hanged, drawn, and quartered. In the correspondence which had been captured, Queen Mary had actually been quite subtle and had never overtly given her express support to the plotters. So she escaped being implicated in a clear way, even though it was an open secret that she had been involved in some measure. Without the definitive proof that would seal her fate, Walsingham was annoyed but did not give up. Next, Walsingham concocted what in many ways amounted to a sting operation, the so-called Babington plot. Mary continued under house arrest, and Walsingham worked at the same time to infiltrate the English Catholic circles around her. Walsingham sent his spies abroad to insinuate themselves into the English Catholic exile community. And in 1585, he made a breakthrough. He found a double agent, Gilbert Gifford, in the network of supporters of Mary. Gifford was from an English Catholic family. He had been expelled from two seminaries, and probably out of resentment, he decided to work for Walsingham. Gifford gained the trust of Mary's supporters in Paris and then traveled to England, volunteering to help by being a courier for the passing of messages from the French embassy in London to Mary under house arrest in a manner. Mary's supporters agreed, and so now Walsingham had achieved what he wanted. He'd provided the plotters with a channel of communication, but one that he himself observed and controlled. And this channel involved a beer barrel. A brewer made local deliveries of beer to the manor house where Mary was under house arrest. So Gifford bribed the brewer to allow him to slip a message into a stoppered tube that would be inserted into the beer barrel. Messages could reach Mary, and her messages could go out to supporters by way of the beer barrel. These messages were in code, but Walsingham's code breakers, who intercepted and read them, were able to decipher them relatively easily. Slowly but surely, Walsingham was enmeshing Mary and her supporters in his web of illusions. Among Mary's supporters in London were 13 young and pretty disorganized men organizing a planned rebellion. At their center was a 25-year-old law student named Anthony Babington. Their plan was to launch the rebellion by assassinating Queen Elizabeth, and this was meant to be a clarion call for a national uprising. Gifford, along with other double agents employed by Walsingham, had become part of the group around Babington. Babington wrote out the details of the conspiracy they were hatching, including the plan to kill Queen Elizabeth, and sent it to Mary for her approval. In July 1586, Mary's reply came in the secret correspondence, and it sealed her fate, because this time Mary had been incautious and had implicated herself by agreeing to the plan. Her letter ended with a plea that the letter be burned immediately. What she didn't know was that Walsingham had read it on its route to her supporters. At this point, Babington seems to have wanted to just forget about the entire plot, and he discovered at this moment that one of his friends was an agent for Walsingham. Imagine the horror of that moment for the plotter, finding that he was about to be caught. He and other plotters tried to flee, but they were not able to escape. One reason is that they were hampered by having had a group portrait made of themselves in advance of the conspiracy. So here's a practical lesson to take away. Conspirators should not have formal portraits made of their group. Using this as a way of tracking them down, all plotters were captured and then on September 1586 were drawn and quartered. But the real drama was yet to come. Walsingham had the smoking gun he needed to convince Queen Elizabeth that Mary was a fatal danger. Even now, Elizabeth, who did not want a cousin's blood on her hands, was reluctant but finally agreed to a public trial, which took place at Fotheringay Castle in 1586. Queen Elizabeth hesitated some more, but then finally, after the conviction of Mary, Queen of Scots, on February 8, 1587, Mary was executed in a gruesomely botched ritualized death, needing three blows of the axe before the sentence was completed. The next crisis grew out of this, for King Philip of Spain prepared for an invasion of England, the 1588 Spanish Armada, conceived of as a crusade against this Protestant country. The Great Armada has been called the worst-kept secret of the age. News of the Spanish plans spread throughout all of Europe by incautious diplomats and spies, and indeed, today, historians can find multiple copies of the plans in the Royal Archives of Europe. Philip II complained that the English must be using black magic because they were able to learn his plans so readily. They didn't need black magic, they just needed Walsingham's skills as a spy master. Walsingham had even outlined a special plan called the Plat for Intelligence out of Spain and used the leaks in diplomatic correspondence to gain advance warning of the Armada. Ultimately, the intelligence wasn't decisive. The running naval battle against the capable English navy and the force of a storm that battered the Spanish Armada, in fact, doomed that enterprise. Half its ships were lost and thousands died. After this victory, Walsingham was congratulated for having done much to win this war by the use of his pen rather than weapons. Yet the story of Walsingham has an ending that's not one of triumph and reward. Walsingham died poor and miserable in 1590, having bankrupted himself in the service of Queen Elizabeth, who would not repay his loyalty. Many of his tradecraft secrets would be lost and his organization dissolved. There's a famous anecdote about his death. A Spanish agent in London reported to King Philip of Spain that there was mourning for the death of Walsingham, this fascinating man. King Philip wrote in the margins of the report, "Ah, but it's very good news here in Spain." In the next decade, there came another example of the swirling plots and intrigues of this time and place, the Gunpowder Plot of 1605. This was a plot directed against, of all people, the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, King James I of England, who had succeeded Queen Elizabeth on her death in 1603. The plot was named after one of its principal conspirators, Guy Fawkes, who, along with other English Catholics, intended to kill King James I and the cream of the Protestant nobility by blowing up the English Parliament on its state opening day, all of which was meant to spark a national revolt to put a Catholic monarch on the throne. This was massively unrealistic, as Catholics by this point represented a small and embattled minority, a poor basis for a nationwide uprising. In those days, the basement chambers under Parliament could actually be rented by private individuals, and this is what one of the conspirators did. Gunpowder barrels were to be assembled there secretly, and Guy Fawkes, this was a plan, would light a slow fuse and then slip away by boat and head for Europe. Fawkes was a fascinating character, having served abroad as a mercenary in the Spanish army in the Netherlands, what is today Belgium. But the plot was exposed because of bungling, because of a mistake. In circumstances that are still mysterious, one of the plotters apparently wrote an anonymous warning to one of the Catholic noblemen, Lord Monteagle, to stay away from Parliament's opening ceremonies. Monteagle loyally informed the Secretary of State, Robert Cecil, of this threat, and a midnight search of Parliament was undertaken. Guy Fawkes was discovered attending to a grand total of 36 barrels of gunpowder in the basement, ready for being exploded to perpetrate the gunpowder plot. The conspirators were captured. They were hanged, drawn, and quartered. Among their number was a Jesuit priest, who was judged to be implicated in keeping the treason secret by having heard confessions of the plotters and not having intervened against them. Now, certain aspects of the gunpowder plot are still shrouded in mystery. Some historians have argued that this whole incompetent and unrealistic plot was in fact so poorly managed that it must have been a provocation meant to discredit the Catholic minority and Jesuits by implication. Some even speculate that it might have been the brainchild of the Secretary of State, Robert Cecil, but the evidence doesn't bear this out. The memory of the plot did leave deep marks. The foiling of this attempt was seen as a sign of divine favor and suggested once again, as many had believed, that God was a Protestant Englishman. Ever since and still today, the Houses of Parliament are ceremonially searched every year by the Yeomen of the Guard before the opening event, both to mark this event and to make sure that no similar security breaches happen again. In the years that followed, a national holiday grew up around this event, a celebration of the thwarting of a terrorist plot. And it even entered the world of nursery rhymes and gained a kind of immortality. The nursery rhyme put it thus: "Remember, remember, the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason, and plot. I see no reason why gunpowder treason should ever be forgot." And still, to this very day in Britain, there's a tradition that testifies to the memory of the gunpowder plot. A tradition of special bonfires called Burning the Guy on November 5th and accompanied by fireworks. The ritual involves this. Children create eccentric effigies or cobble together what looks like a human being. And these effigies are called guys in memory of Guy Fawkes, and they're destined for a bonfire. And in advance of this bonfire, children will drag these effigies around town collecting money for fireworks and urging people to show their solidarity with the symbolism of this event, though today many children must not be aware of the deeper historical background. Over time, there was an interesting linguistic legacy. The word guy came to mean anybody who dressed eccentrically or resembled one of these scarecrow images. And then, especially in American English, the word guy came to mean not just someone dressed eccentrically, but any man, you guys. So when in our language today we refer to someone as guy, the language is remembering a long-ago historical event, even if we have forgotten. In this lecture, we've seen in the particular case of England and of Mr. Secretary Walsingham, the struggle to create institutions and forms for espionage, to invent them on the spot. This would now be a venture that would expand to a world stage in the age of discovery, which we consider in our next lecture.